It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The spread of disinformation across social media platforms is nothing new, but it seems like we're seeing more and more bad information, doctored videos, conspiracy theories, and fake news every day. To fight that, Carnegie Mellon University has created the Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity. They're calling it IDEAS for short. Kathleen Carley is a computer science professor at CMU, and she'll be directing the new research center. She spoke with the Confluence's Megan Harris.
So, Kathleen, how dangerous is misinformation, especially when it can be spread so easily now?
Well, some disinformation is just simply not dangerous, right? Like when you see a picture of a megastorm or something like that. Other disinformation has actually led to violence, such as in the case of Pizzagate. It's ruined the lives and reputations of individuals. It creates polarization. It affects how you think about the world. So it can have really long-reaching consequences.
What is the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
So disinformation means that you're spreading information that is not true with the intent to deceive. Whereas misinformation is you're spreading information that is not true, but you don't necessarily know that it's not true.
And how does one perceive that intent, especially on the internet where you may not know where something originated?
So proving intent is extremely hard. If it was easy, we wouldn't have a job, I guess. Part of it is looking at who is spreading it, and how many times they've spread similar kinds of information.
You've used the word war to talk about social media, a war on Twitter, on Facebook, on Reddit, that it's all disseminating dangerous falsehoods. How do you stop information like that?
So we need a variety of things. We need new policies and governance. We need ways of prosecuting those who are actually spreading disinformation with the intent to cause harm. We also need new technologies that require data to have providence, information to have providence along with it. We need to create new ways of training people how to recognize it themselves and make groups more resilient in the face of disinformation.
So you expect then to make policy recommendations regarding some prevention, maybe mitigating the spread of disinformation. Do you have any sense yet of government's willingness to address these issues with legislation?
I think there is a growing concern that they are going to need legislation. And all the policymakers I've talked about have been trying to understand just exactly what that legislation might look like and at what level do they need it and where.
Is some degree of that going to be also educating then the legislators?
We hope to be engaged in that as well, yes.
Kathleen, the center's launch is being funded by a $5 million grant from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation. When did the idea for a research center like this come about, and why did CMU think that they were the best place to have it?
So at CMU, we've been doing research in disinformation and social media analytics for a long time.
And that technology component as well.
That's right. And we also knew that this problem was not only important, but it had to be solved from an interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary approach with an applied approach. And that's CMU's wheelhouse. And then the Knight Foundation wanted to work in this area. And so we are very thankful to them for their generosity in helping us launch this.
So what are the initial goals? Is it all data gathering about how some of these fake stories are spread?
No, we actually have a lot of data. But our real goal is to enhance social cybersecurity. There's over 2,000 researchers in this country alone that are working in this area. We want to build that community so they know about each other and work collaboratively. We want to engage in outreach because there's a lot we know that is just not known by policymakers or companies or journalists, and we want to spread that information. And third, we want to engage in new research with new techniques for identifying who is doing it, why are they doing it, what are the early indicators and warning, how can you make groups inoculated against disinformation, and how can you counter it?
So how do you inoculate, and how do you teach the rest of us?
So one of the ways of inoculating groups against disinformation is to teach them strategies for searching for the primary source of information. Mm-hmm. Another way is simply to help them recognize when the groups they're in are collapsing and they're not getting a breadth of opinion.
Collapsing. Talk more about that.
So one of the ways in which you spread disinformation is you don't just send out stories. You actually shape groups by building connections between people who may not know each other. And as groups get tighter and tighter in these connections, and they start talking about the same topic over and over, they become an echo chamber. And it's like a pathology. So once you get into that form, you start ignoring information from the outside. You start responding to things emotionally rather than rationally. And so if you can give people indicators that the group they're in is becoming that way and teach them that that's a pathological form, the idea is that could help improve and inoculate them.
Do you think that the people in these echo chambers, whether it's ideological or political, want to be told that maybe they're being a bit too emotional or thinking with too much emotion?
I think some people do, and I think there'll be some people always who don't.
Fair enough. So you're planning to collaborate with a few researchers from a number of different disciplines. How do you think fields like sociology, psychology, even philosophy can contribute?
Well, so I actually am a sociologist by training, but I do work with artificial intelligence. So one of the ways we combine these is by having teams, a mixture of people from multiple disciplines working together, working on the same problem, learning each other's language, and so on. And then we train students jointly in the features of the different disciplines.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and our guest is Kathleen Carley, computer science professor who has been appointed to be director of CMU's new Center for Informed Democracy. I understand that the center is going to be looking at technology and the human aspect of the spread of disinformation. Which would you say is more dangerous?
Both. I would say you can't just solve the technology in and of itself, because if you do, I mean, people are good at getting around technology always.
Right.
So we actually believe that it has to be a joint solution and that you actually have to bring the people side, the technology side, and the policy side, all three together at the same time.
So how do you counteract then that human element? And do people want to stop this spread?
Actually, a lot of people do, and they are. So we actually had a really funny case where we were actually looking at the Black Panther movie, which, you know, you go, what? That's kind of silly. But we knew the Black Panther movie would elicit, you know, misinformation or disinformation because it's just, it's going to ring a lot of bells.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, there was a disinformation campaign right away that was basically showing images of people and they said, I went to the movie and I got beaten up. And the implication was I'm white, so that's why I got beaten up. That disinformation campaign died really, really rapidly, not because scientists stopped it, not because the government stopped it, but because people stopped it. They started countering it by calling it out, saying this never happened, that wasn't a theater, and they started calling it out by sending a counter story saying, I went to the movie and got beaten up, but the image they showed were things like SpongeBob SquarePants with a bandage on him.
So if people want to spread partial information or completely false information, will they do it regardless?
Yes. In fact, people spread false information without even realizing they are. Other people spread it for fun. And so
just natural sense of exaggeration?
Yes. But also just because they don't realize the consequences. So, for example, some kids after this one sporting event actually sent out a message showing this, the kid said, our little brother was lost at this thing, help us find him, not reeling that it would lead to this huge manhunt. And it was really the poster child for autism.
Oh, you mean that the photo that they were sharing was literally on a poster?
Yes.
Regarding autism?
Yeah. Yeah, so some people do it just not realizing the consequences.
So how then will the Idea Center help combat some of this or study it long term?
So several ways. One is that we're actually developing new technologies that can spot certain kinds of disinformation and those who spread it, like bots and so on. We're also developing things that help you spot one of the prominent ways disinformation is spread, like the finding of memes. But we're also developing new critical thinking techniques so we can help train people, the next generation, in how to spot disinformation on their own. And we'll also be working with policymakers and journalists, spreading our findings and helping and trying to work with them to come up with new joint solutions.
That tech, how will that work? How will it be able to spot some of these things out in the wild?
For many of these things, we have some historic examples, and you can actually train the tools using artificial intelligence techniques to spot things like those. That's kind of the first generation tools. The second generation, though, is the case where these things are changing so rapidly that you don't have enough to train it. So we're developing systems that, without large quantities of training material, can also spot things by working alongside the human, like a human aid, to help the two of them spot anomalies that aren't human.
What are you personally most excited about?
So one of the things that I think is exciting in this area is the fact that we are getting findings. And we do understand now that there's not one type of disinformation, but many, many types. And we're starting to understand how those spread in different ways. And I would just like people to know that there's these approaches out there, and that we'll be doing things like webcasting, seminars, and so on, so that, you know, everybody can learn more.
So lots to come as the Ideas Center evolves. And of course, this is not the beginning. It's an extension of ongoing work. Can you give us a taste of your findings so far?
So many times people will send out disinformation, and then if they're caught, will claim that it was only satire.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's one thing. Second thing, that spreading disinformation effectively requires building and shaping the group that is going to respond to it, not just spreading the information, so they can exploit the prioritization schemes for those media. The third thing we found is that one of the ways disinformation campaigns are most effective is because they make it appear that everyone in your group agrees with the statement. And sometimes that's because they re-message from your account. Sometimes that's because they infiltrate your group and make it look like they're members when they really aren't, and so on. Those are three findings.
So if any of our listeners see this sort of thing happening on their social media channels, what should they do?
So one thing, and we've already seen this happening, is people can start to combat things by simply calling out disinformation when they see it. They can also use satire itself as a way of combating disinformation. The third thing that can be done is if you build your communities and your groups, but you sort of vet them, you actually know who the people are, and that actually is another way of beginning to combat that.
Satire seems like a pretty strategic argument. If you see that tactic being used, does that mean that it could be part of a targeted campaign pre-planned in some way?
Yes, absolutely. A lot of this is done by very sophisticated agents, and some of the most effective disinformation campaigns are actually designed as these huge campaigns, and they're laid out over the course of multiple months with new events and new stories and so on. Yes.
Are you finding much about the source of some of this disinformation?
Well, we know the apparent source. So the apparent source might be this bot or this troll or this person. But the underlying source, like, is this from Russia or is this from Iraq?
Yeah, is it a domestic actor? Is it foreign?
Yeah.
Do they have an ideology they're trying to
spread?
That
is something that we have guesses at, but I would say that that's where a lot of the research needs to be done.
Well, we look forward to seeing where it goes. Kathleen Carley is a computer science professor at Carnegie Mellon University, and she'll be directing CMU's new Center for Informed Democracy and Social Cybersecurity. Kathleen, thanks so much for being here.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Hannah Gaskell with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pittsburgh gets its second newspaper in 1800. The Tree of Liberty was created by writer and lawyer John Israel as the antithesis to the then Pittsburgh Gazette, the paper we know today as the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. It would later come to represent a widening political gap in Western Pennsylvania's Republican Party between Federalists and Jeffersonians. Publication of the paper would cease 10 years later in 1810. A copy can be found at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The flats, slopes, and riverfront on Pittsburgh's south side are all part of what gives the neighborhood its distinctive feel. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more on a group of volunteers working to make the community a cleaner, safer, and more vibrant place to work and live.
Whether it's the middle of the day or the middle of the night, the South Side is bustling with activity in and around its coffee shops, bars, shops, and restaurants. The Southside Community Council is a volunteer group that acts as the glue that holds together homeowners, businesses, and advocates for the neighborhood's residents.
It helps us better understand what's happening here on the Southside as it relates to parking, as it relates to crime, as it relates to Carson Street activity. It's an opportunity for residents to come to speak about some of the issues that they've had difficulty having remedied.
Barbara Rudiak, president of the Southside Community Council, says she and other board members engage community members about problems in the area, then form strategic plans to address them.
One in particular, you know, parking is a significant issue on the South Side, and many residents will be upset if a car is parked in front of a fire hydrant or somewhere that is dangerous when you're thinking about fire trucks getting by or emergency vehicles.
In addition to planning for the South Side's future, Rudiak says it's also important to preserve the neighborhood's past, which the council has set out to do with a recorded oral history series called Southside Voices.
With every passing day, we lose history told by the people who have lived it. And what we did, we started to do last year, was record the stories of residents. And within those stories, we heard a lot about, you know, the churches they may have gone to or the family experiences. But it gave us an opportunity to capture some of our history, and it's something that we'll continue doing.
In the 40s, 50s, 60s, community was created organically by the ethnic group that you were born into and how that group interacted with all the other ethnic groups down here.
Board member Frank Vitale.
But when the mills closed in the late 70s, early 80s, all that went away. And so what I see the community council doing in an unspoken way is creating community, but also the very fact that you are bringing people together.
Vitale says bringing residents closer together and building positive relationships is one of the council's overarching goals.
People who wouldn't necessarily know each other or would have met each other down here now are friends.
Barbara Rudiak says the work of the Southside Community Council, the beautification of parks and streets, the upkeep of homes and businesses is never ending. But the reward of a closer community is well worth the work.
As we continue with the work of the Community Council, we want you to be safe and have a good quality of life.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This spring, University of Pittsburgh law professor Jerry Dickinson announced a campaign to challenge veteran Democrat Mike Doyle in next year's 18th congressional district. Since then, Dickinson has raised over $100,000, much of that from outside the area. And politicos are taking note of his bid. Dickinson spoke with 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter about why he's running, why voters should look for a change in leadership, and how growing up in a foster home of 11 children shaped his politics.
I'm a hometown guy. You know, I used to say, you know, come out of the Orphans Court Division back in the 80s through the foster care system and ended up at a large foster home out in Shaler Township, a multiracial Brady Bunch family. We struggled. And we've all been hit in some way, shape, or form with all these things that are affecting our lives. Incarceration, addiction, we've been hit with homelessness, we've been hit with joblessness, we've been hit with the low-wage sector. And that fundamentally shapes your worldview. You know, I have sat on the inside walls of prisons, meeting with correctional officers and wardens, and trying to get a fair deal for a brother who's been thrown into solitary confinement. And he's a white man, and he's my brother. So a lot of my desire to change the world is driven by those personal experiences.
This is your first run for any sort of public office, right? So why this race? Why now?
We're in a moment of constitutional crisis. Democratic institutions are being destroyed. Constitutional norms are being ignored by the president. Right? We're in uncharted territory in the country. You know, that constitutional crisis is ongoing, but on the ground level, we have this housing crisis. All throughout the United States, millions of Americans can't keep up with their rent. Millions of Americans can't save enough money to own a home. That's a problem, and it's happening here in the 18th Congressional District. And so there's a certain sense of urgency throughout the country, but also in this district, of having a representative who's going to be on the ground, being an advocate, and being a loud voice. We are in a totally new era where you actually have to fight. And if we have Democrats who aren't going to be pushing and fighting, you're going to get challenged, and you're going to be held accountable, and perhaps you may lose your seat.
So let's talk about Mr. Doyle. How would you characterize his performance in particular with respect to the president and on these issues?
Low-key, not a loud voice, and we need more. You know, it's this idea that just voting the right way is good enough. That's simply not good enough today. This is a progressive district. You can be the loudest person in Congress. You can be the leader on all the major issues. Why not? I'm obviously going to be that. And I've been willing to submit testimony to the U.S. Senate on the Trump border wall and other issues. What happens when we get in the Congress? It's going to be even better. If you have been supportive of the Hyde Amendment, which prohibits federal funding to local and state governments for purposes of resources for abortions, if you've been supportive of that, you need to be held accountable for why. That amendment has a disproportionate impact on low-income women. Why have you supported that?
You mentioned housing as a key issue. Talk a bit about that, what you would want to bring to the table, what your kind of policy fix for this question of affordability in Pittsburgh and places like it would be.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, millions of Americans can't keep up with the rent. Millions of Americans are being displaced and gentrified out of their neighborhoods. It's happening here in the 18th Congressional District. It's happening elsewhere. We need to figure out ways to help renters, right, to keep up with their rent. And because otherwise, we're heading down a road of a tale of two cities, a tale of two regions. One for the rich who can play in the playground, and one for the poor who and working class who just don't have access to the playground. I'm talking about incentives. You know, where a municipality is showing their best efforts on affordable housing, that in and of itself should be an incentive for the local municipality to receive some type of funding from the federal government, additional funds. You could think about this in terms of, you know, a federal affordable housing trust fund. You know, Pittsburgh is a success story in many ways post-industrial, and we want to, of course, bring that to the table nationally. But at the same time, we want to be able to take the issues that are permeating this district, poverty, criminal justice reform, affordable housing, the healthcare crisis. We also want to bring that to the national debate. One might say, what's happening in this candidacy, this is just a microcosm of a desire, a mood within the Democratic Party to make change for the good. And we're excited about it.
That's WESA's Chris Potter speaking with Jerry Dickinson, who is challenging longtime Democratic Congressman Mike Doyle, who spoke to my WESA colleague Lucy Perkins. In the wake of the mass shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio, there have been renewed calls from both sides of the aisle for gun control measures, but it's unlikely the Senate will pass any legislation. WESA sat down with Congressman Doyle, who supports sweeping reform. He says he's frustrated with Senate Republicans, including Pennsylvania's Pat Toomey. Toomey suggests there isn't enough Senate support to pass background check legislation.
I don't know what it takes. We've seen this tragedy in Pittsburgh. It's everywhere. And the Senate owes the American people at least to put themselves on record and say where they stand on these things. I personally would go a lot further. I don't believe military weapons should be sold to civilians. If that shooter in Dayton had a handgun or a hunting rifle, he couldn't have shot 43 times in 30 seconds. It's just not possible. No one's talking about taking away people's hunting rifles or even a handgun. But these weapons that allow you to shoot 100 bullets without reloading, what's the civilian purpose for that? You know, people are selling these bulletproof book bags now for their kids. What do you tell a 5-year-old when they're going to kindergarten that we're giving you this book bag, but you know, if a shooter comes, you got to put it in front of you? I mean, what is that doing to young people's minds? I don't want to live that way, and I don't think most Americans want to live that way. But it's going to take some courage on the part of some elected officials who, from whatever reason, are more afraid of gun manufacturers and the NRA than they are with their constituents they can home. And I think that's terrible.
Many have linked the manifesto believed to be written by the alleged shooter in El Paso to President Trump's rhetoric, his anti-immigration rhetoric. To what extent do you think that the president bears a responsibility for something like this?
Words matter. And especially when those words come from the President of the United States. The use of the term invasion, when he talks about people invading the country, that stokes up images in some people's minds, especially some people who are filling their minds with other hate rhetoric, that somehow it's their duty to somehow stop this invasion, that these people are coming to harm us. And, you know, that kind of rhetoric has consequences. At one of the rallies, he talked about an invasion. How do we stop it? And someone in the audience yelled, "Shoot them." And people laughed, and he laughed. I mean, really? What kind of message is that sending when the president talks that way? And we recently heard President Obama basically said that as leaders, we have a responsibility to not use the kind of rhetoric or language that incites people's worst behavior or that pits one group of people against another group of people. And you can't go in front of a press conference when a tragedy happens and talk about unity and then the next evening tweet something out on Twitter that divides us again.
You are being challenged in this 2020 primary, this upcoming primary, by Gerald Dickinson. He's a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Something that he says is that the district that you represent is more progressive than its current representation. And in this current political climate, Pittsburgh should be a louder Democratic voice. Well, how do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, I don't have opponents yet. And there's three people that I've read that are interested in my seat, and I'm sure there might be more than that come the filing deadline. So to pay particular attention to any one of three candidates who have expressed interest, and I would say before the filing deadline that number could grow, I don't really pay much attention to. My job is to represent the people of the 18th Congressional District. And if I do my job, elections take care of themselves. I don't waste a lot of my time worrying about what other people say who may or may not be on a ballot 8 months from now. I think my record reflects the people of Pittsburgh. I've lived in my district my entire life. I've married to my wife for 44 years and we've raised four children here. And I think I have a pretty good idea what Pittsburghers and people in the 18th Congressional District think. And I think the fact that they've sent me back as many times as they have is proof that I do reflect their hopes and dreams and their values.
You're holding a town hall next week here in Pittsburgh on climate change. This isn't your first issue-focused town hall. You talked about the Affordable Care Act in 2017. Why are you choosing issue-based town halls as opposed to more typical expected town halls where people can just come and voice their concerns or ask questions of you?
You know, when you have a town hall where you can talk just about anything, often it strays into local issues, issues that aren't really before the federal government. We're never going to be able to tackle issues like health care and climate change unless we can get good information out to people and at least be able to stipulate, here's the facts, you know, here's what science is telling us. I find you lose some of that focus if it's a general meeting where someone may say, you know, when are these potholes going to get fixed? Or maybe it's a state issue. So I try to focus these town hall issues on the really tough issues that are confronting the country.
You called for an impeachment inquiry to begin against President Trump back in June. And since then, a majority of your fellow House Democrats have called for an inquiry to begin as well. But it's still an issue that's really kind of divided your party. There are Democrats in more moderate districts than yours, like Connor Lamb, who have not called for any inquiry to begin. And I'm just curious, when a politician is weighing a question like impeachment, a serious question like this, to what extent should they weigh their own reelection or the broader impact of their party's future success in upcoming elections?
I really didn't think of it in a political term, like is this politically popular in my district or not? I think it's probably split here too. For me, it was a matter of, are we a nation of laws or aren't we? I wasn't originally, you know, first person to sign on to an impeachment inquiry. I wanted to see the process take its course. I wanted the committees of jurisdiction to do the job that the Constitution requires them to do on oversight. Where it changed for me is when it became obvious to me that the administration had no intentions of cooperating, telling witnesses to not honor subpoenas, refusing to hand over information and trying to just run the clock out in the courts. And so it became apparent to me that we needed a stronger tool to enable these committees to be able to do their job. So for me, my decision to sign on to an impeachment inquiry was to give the committees of jurisdiction additional powers to be able to do their job. No president or no administration is above the law. And to tell members of your staff not to comply with subpoenas and to not hand over information, to me is the beginning of a very dangerous precedent in the country if we're not going to respect the laws of our country.
Congressman Doyle, thank you for speaking with me.
My pleasure.
That was 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins speaking with Pittsburgh area Congressman Mike Doyle. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Highland One Reservoir in Highland Park should soon be back in operation after 2 years offline. What's being done to meet stricter water control requirements, and how has the city's water supply been affected? Will Pickering is the Director of Public Affairs for Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. Welcome back to The Confluence, Will.
Great to be here, Kevin.
Let's start with who owns the reservoir. Is it PWSA? Is it the city? What is it?
So PWSA operates under a lease with the city. So the city owns these assets. And the water authority was spun off through a lease agreement. So we're responsible for maintaining the reservoir within the park. It's a city park, but ultimately the city owns the asset.
But that could change in a few years, maybe?
Yes, the lease agreement is set to expire, and there's a provision in the lease agreement for PWSA to potentially purchase the assets for $1. So those will be discussions that are being will be going on in the future, I'm sure, between our board and the city.
Well, remind us, what started this shutdown of Highland One? What was wrong with the reservoir?
Sure. So back in February 2017, listeners may recall there was a large boil water advisory for most of the east end of the city. And that's because the Highland One reservoir, which is uncovered, there were some concerns that the water that was being treated there had low chlorine levels. And as we worked with the DEP to determine what might be causing that, we decided with their agreement that we would take the reservoir offline and make some additional treatment and monitoring improvements to ensure that this water met or was better than our water quality standards.
Mm-hmm. So what has happened since the Department of Environmental Protection worked with you? What measures has PWSA taken?
So we signed a consent agreement that laid out a number of different improvements we're making out at the reservoir. First and foremost, we're adding ultraviolet treatment at the microfiltration plant.
What does that do?
So it's using light to disinfect the water. Microfiltration was fairly high tech at the time of construction in the late 90s, early 2000s. Ultraviolet is sort of the next wave of modern water treatment. And this additional treatment is important because the reservoir is uncovered. So certain contaminants might be able to, wildlife, bird droppings, things of the like. We want to be able to filter that out before that water actually hits the pipes to deliver it from homes. So this ultraviolet treatment is an additional layer of protection that we're providing, which will make a big difference and allow us to bring the reservoir back online.
So not a substitute and added on to other methods of disinfection.
That's exactly true.
So the state steps in, works with PWSA, and imposes these stricter safety protocols. How much of a challenge was the age of the reservoir itself? It's well over a century old, correct?
That's correct. It was built in 1879, I'm told, so we're pushing 140 years. And the Highland One Reservoir is really a critical piece of infrastructure. It's located there because of its elevation. We like to use gravity to feed water through our water system versus pumping, mm-hmm. which is very energy intensive. But thankfully, we're blessed with a system that was created a long time ago for a city that was using a lot more water. We had industry in Pittsburgh that we no longer have. So there's a lot of added capacity where we could pull from other areas of the distribution system to make up for this reservoir not being a resource for us to rely on for the last couple of years.
And you alluded to it, the challenge of an open reservoir. It's a nice view for residents who want to walk around, take a stroll, but it's more susceptible to pollutants.
Yeah, that's a reality, and that is one of the reasons why we built the microfiltration plant in the early 2000s, and it's why we're adding the additional treatment not to mention the additional security enhancements. Uh-huh. So last week we announced that we're going to be improving the wall that surrounds the reservoir to prevent things like debris, or we've had an issue with ducklings. If we close up some of these holes, our experts who know about wildlife have said that hopefully it's going to prevent these ducklings from entering. And then just things like video cameras and security bollards to make sure that, you know, while it's a beautiful community amenity, it's also an important facet of our drinking water system. We have to ensure that it remains safe and clean.
So we're not talking about accidental tampering there that could be to thwart intentional tampering of the water supply?
That is always a concern. It's a concern that DEP had and we share, and it's one of the reasons why we're not just adding cameras, but adding physical human security elements as well to keep an eye on this.
Did you ever consider capping it, putting a roof on the open reservoir?
It's a great question, and it's my understanding that in the 90s, when the city was facing a new requirement from EPA to cover all of our reservoirs, we did cover all of them except for the Highland 1 reservoir because the community felt so strongly about having it as an asset, you know, that it is nice to stroll around, especially this time of year. And instead of capping it, we built the microfiltration plant. DEP asked for us to consider it again when we confronted this issue in February 2017. And we felt that making improvements, at least on an interim basis, to the treatment plant wouldn't necessitate capping or covering this reservoir. But so, it is something we're thinking about.
So did DEP want it, suggest it?
They gave us options. Okay. So they said either cover it or explore ultraviolet treatment or additional treatments to give that added layer of protection.
So you've been dealing with this lack of this water resource for a couple years now. What have you had to do to make sure customers have adequate supplies?
That's a great question. Like I said, we're blessed with a system that is much larger than what we need. And we're also blessed with some really creative folks in our operators who actually manage the flow of water. And so one thing we've been able to do, Highland Park also has another reservoir, what we call the Highland 2 reservoir, which is across the street, and that is a covered reservoir that serves a different third of the city. And we're able to pump water from that reservoir into the Highland 1 system to make up for any demand. So this time of year, when on a hot day, it could be a high use. We move water from Highland 2 over to the Highland 1 system, and we kind of perform a juggling act that we wouldn't otherwise have to do if the reservoir was online, but we've been able to make do.
PWSA has been adding a chemical, orthophosphate, to the water to line the pipes to block lead from leaching into the water. Has the chemical also been added to the reservoir?
So that's a great question. And the orthophosphate treated water actually is not added at the reservoir because if it were, it could cause algae. It's added actually after that water is retreated at the microfiltration plant so that the orthophosphate treated water isn't exposed to air. So folks may remember the construction project that we had earlier out in Highland Park was building these additive facilities that are adding it after the treatment process.
So again, visitors have been able to walk around the park, but starting when, they will not be around because of construction of some walls?
In the next few days, we're going to restrict the access so we can perform the construction safely. We'll put out an additional release when we have the date certain, but it is in the coming days, and it's going to unfortunately be closed through spring.
Will the average PWSA customer notice a difference with it back online?
We hope not. These are sort of the things that happen behind the scenes that we don't want our customers to have to worry about. The water that is entering the system is going to have this additional layer, so folks might feel more comfortable with the level of water quality. But we're working our magic behind the scenes to make sure that if there were a fire, if there were a main break, that we're supplying enough water that we need to ensure that our city remains safe and supplied with clean water.
And when will this be back in full operation?
By the end of the month.
All right. Will Pickering is Director of Public Affairs for Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. Will, thanks so much for being here.
Great to be here, Kevin. Thanks.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, police departments have been using surveillance cameras for years, but the Allegheny County District Attorney's Office has assembled its own network of cameras. What information is it gathering and storing? And is it vulnerable to being hacked? If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered by Tom Hurley. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, Hope you have a good day of good news.